Well, you guys may not realize this, but for many years, Passover, along with the Day of Atonement, were the two festivals that I dreaded. Did never look forward to Passover. To me, going to Passover was like going to English class. It was something you would go to, and as soon as you got through the door, you would start watching that clock and counting down the minutes till it was over, because I hated English. And those of you who are in the Hebrew class, you probably can see that, because I know very little about grammar and things like that, and I just hated it. I did have one good English teacher throughout my high school year. Her name was Miss Ritchie, and she tried to drill it into me because she was... The way she approached teaching, she was a little bit better than most of them. But anyway, I hated English class, and that was the way it was with Passover. I thought the festivals were supposed to be festive. And so how do you get something festive out of the Day of Atonement? And how could we get something, at least from my background, how could I get anything festive out of Passover? And for those of you who share the background that I have, you know what I'm talking about. You know exactly what I'm talking about. My first experience with Passover was in 1969. In 1969, it was the first year my parents were able to come and attend church with us, where we were a part of a Sabbath-keeping organization that also kept the festivals. And so one night during the week, I think it was a Wednesday or Thursday night, my mom and dad said, okay, we're all going to church tonight. And I thought, well, that's sort of strange, because we didn't go to church during the week. We didn't typically have Wednesday night church. And so me and my brothers and my sister, we all loaded up into our Country Squire station wagon. They don't have these things anymore, station wagons. But we all loaded up into the station wagon, and we drove 60 miles up to Ada, Oklahoma. And I was 69, so I was... 15 years old. So I had a little bit of recollection of that. And so we were driving up there, and as we pulled into the place where we were meeting, first thing I noticed is that the windows to this community building that we met in all had paper taped to the doors, like newspaper that probably some type of wrapping paper, all taped to the doors and windows so you couldn't see in. And I said, that's sort of strange. And so, and then as we were all getting ready to jump out of the car, Mom and Dad said, "You guys wait here. We'll be back in a few minutes." And about an hour and a half later, they came back out the door. And unlike what it was on our normal Sabbath, where everybody came out and they were jovial and they were shaking hands and all this, everybody just came out real quiet, real somber. Mom and Dad got in the car, never said a word, other than, "Did you guys get along with each other?" Or something to that effect. But they never said a word. And all the way home, just hardly a word spoken between them. And we got home that night, not much was said. And so I thought, this is sort of weird. So anyway, I didn't think anything much more about it, because the next day we got up early in the morning, left the house about 7 o'clock in the morning, and drove 120 miles to the north side of Oklahoma City to keep the first day of unleavened bread. And then when we got there, everybody was jovial. Everything was happy. Everybody was shaking hands. Everything was just great, you know. I said, "Whoo, what changed from last night?" So there was a little bit of difference there. Next year, we didn't go with Mom and Dad to keep Passover. We just stayed home. At least all of the kids did. But Mom and Dad went back up to Ada, and they had Passover again that year. But that year, all of us kids stayed at home. And continued like that until I left home in 1973. And from that point on, whenever there was Passover, I knew that I wasn't invited. And so I didn't really think much about Passover until 1978. In 1978, I moved to Big Sandy. I had met Angie. And as part of my working my way back into the church scene, you might say, after all, I was marrying a college girl, and so I had to at least look somewhat religious. And so I decided to go to Passover. I was able to go as a guest to Passover with a friend of mine named Paul Jarbo. And Paul and I went in and sat in on Passover services, and then I could see why those people were filing out very, very solemnly and stuff like that. And the reason was because the Passover service basically started with a foot washing service. And after that, it was basically, other than sharing bread and wine, it was a talk about, it was reading the passages out of John about the Last Supper. And they were always sort of conveyed in this sorrowful way. And so I understood what Passover was about. And then next year, I actually participated in Passover because I was baptized in the spring of 79 or fall of 78, something like that. And we kept Passover, Angie and I then, we kept Passover that way from 1979. She had been keeping Passover before, but kept Passover that way from 1979 all the way down to 1997 when Angie and I stepped out of the box. And when we stepped out of the box, we came to understand Passover in a little bit different point of view, you might say. And from 1979 to now, we have spent countless hours studying Passover. In fact, even before then, while I was even part of the church, I would see the conflicts between the way we were keeping Passover and the way that I saw the Bible. And I said, there's something that just doesn't add up here. So there in 1979, we kept Passover thing with Jim, Joseph Good, and Mitchell Smith. Talked about him a couple weeks ago. It was our first out-of-the-box, out-of-the-church organization Passover, and it was totally different than what I had remembered before. In fact, I can still remember correcting Joseph Good on the way he was conducting the Passover service because, of course, I knew better. And so, but he just ignored me. He didn't correct me. He just ignored me, which is, I'm thankful for that. Anyway, so we've been conducting Passovers, basically, though, since that time, either in our home or in other people's homes, and sometimes over at Jonathan's house in the barn there, we've been conducting Passovers all of that time. And all through these years, I've been studying Passover because I want to learn more and more and more about this. So this year marks Angie's and my 19th out-of-the-box Passover. This will be our 19th time to keep Passover in what I consider to be a more biblical way than what we had done before. And as we conduct Passovers, and we've like I said, we've done a bunch of these things, Angie and I, after the Passover is over with, we would be at home and we would be talking about how we would change something for next year, or something, you know, or something we liked about this year. And we would take and write these down, and we'd make a list of these things. Because sometimes when we came home from Passover, or it was in our home, sometimes after Passover, we felt a big void in our stomachs. Like, that wasn't good at all. But then at other times, we would feel filled up and very excited and thought, oh, that was an awesome Passover. And so through the years, we have taken and written notes down about Passover because I believe that the purpose of Passover is to feel filled up, excited, not feel down and subdued like we had done for so many years before. Excitement and joy, I believe, is what the purpose of the Passover is, and that's the way we should feel when we leave. So when everybody leaves Passover, in my regards, when everybody leaves Passover at that night, if they are filled with joy and excitement, then that has been a successful Passover. At least that's what I want to believe. So this study is intended to be a Passover host manual, you might say, because we have a number of Passover hosts in this room, and this is intended to be somewhat of a manual. It's a compilation of my thoughts over the last 19 years of keeping Passover, and obviously, from the introduction, years before that. It's not a three-step, four-step, five-step formula to having a successful Passover. It's simply thoughts on what make a good Passover and things that might guarantee you have a bad Passover. So this is what this study is about. So in this study, we're going to talk about three things. We're going to focus on your Passover observance. And I'm talking in many ways to the host, though everybody else, you can learn from this. It's your focus on your observance is what's going to really be the key to how your Passover works out. Secondly, it's your desire to fulfill the scriptural Passover requirements. If you've done that, when the Passover is over with, at least what you believe the scriptural Passover requirements are, then you'll probably have a success. And then I'm going to offer some suggestions on how to prepare for and conduct the Passover evening's observance. So let's jump right into this, and we're going to talk about your Passover focus here. This obviously is a Jewish Passover, and you can see it's in their home, and they've got their family there, and maybe another couple there with them. But your focus, how you as a host, what your focus for Passover is going to determine the outcome and the tone of your Passover. Let me back up here, okay? For the Jewish people as a whole, the focus of the Passover has never been a question. They've always known what the focus was. The purpose for in the Jewish person's mind, the purpose for Passover was to retell the events that secured their freedom from Egyptian slavery. That was the goal. You rehearse what took place that removed you or helped you be released from the bondage of Egypt. And because the Jewish people always thought, and they still think that they're the only Israelites around, they think that it's all about them. Them as a people, not individually, but them as a people. But as we're coming into that, and we're realizing that, hey, we're part of the people of Israel as well, then we could take and adopt some of these things that they're, or at least they're focused, because it should be part of our focus as well. But the Jewish focus was on teaching this. And so in order to teach these things, this event that happened that released them from slavery, they developed a number of customs and a number of traditions. And if you've ever read a Jewish Haggadah or a Jewish Passover Seder manual, you would see a number of traditions that they have developed in order to take and explain this whole release from bondage scenario. Excuse me, that Oreo cookie is coming back. So for the Jewish people then, the focus has always been the same. It's always been set for them pretty much. They really never deviate from that. They know what they're going to talk about because it's the same thing every year, because the story never changes every year. It's still the same story. You still read the same words out of the same book. But they also had a goal. Not only did they have a focus, they also had a goal. And that goal was to entrench their children's minds to the fact that God remembered the covenant that he had made with their father Abraham. And because he remembered the covenant, he all but destroyed the Egyptian nation in order to release their freedom. And the vehicle by which this all took place was the death of a one-year-old lamb. So this has been the focus of the Jewish people all down through the ages. The last, basically, 3,500 years, probably 3,000 years at least since the division of the kingdom, 2,700 years, something like that. Okay, that's the Jews, but the Christians have a little bit of a bigger challenge because Christians are pretty new to this Passover thing. And so when Christians get involved in Passover, the first thing that comes to mind, because remember, the left part of the book is off limits, so the right side of the book is where they go to. And the right side of the book is where they see something that looks like a Passover Seder. And that is the Last Supper of Messiah Yeshua. Now, there's, you know, obviously there's people who believe in that that was a Passover, others that do not. And I'm not trying to make a statement there either way. But bottom line is that Christians basically base their Passover off of that one night's events. And so they go into book of John and they see all the things that happened there in John, and they formulate all their traditions based on what they read out of John. And so things like foot washing, which in this little pencil drawing is supposed to be the foot washing that Yeshua did for his disciples. See all those guys sort of standing around saying, "What in the world's going on?" But anyway, they institute this into their service because that was part of that evening's events. Other things like a cup of wine, breaking bread, they see these things, so they incorporate those things into their Passover observance, many times not knowing that these were also part of the Jewish Passover Seder. So, or at least some of them were. So they incorporate these things, this Last Supper thing, but they have a few little twists on how these things are done. For instance, Yeshua washed the disciples' feet, but the disciples didn't wash each other's feet. But in those Christian circles where this is done, usually everybody's washing each other's feet. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not saying there's anything wrong. I'm just saying this is how these things have been incorporated by Christians. And they do it because they're trying to build their own traditions. They're trying to build these things as well in order to have a meaningful Passover Seder. Sometimes a Christian group, when they start to observe Passover, and there's lots of groups out there that are starting to observe Passover, they will focus the whole evening on that one night that Yeshua was crucified. It becomes their entire focus for the evening. And so by doing so, there's things that have to be taken into consideration. For instance, if Yeshua's words and actions become part, or maybe the whole focus of the Passover observance, what happens to the Passover observance that actually God commanded in the Scripture? And we're going to address that a little bit more as we go along. My point in bringing this all out is because you as hosts, you've got to make this determination. What's going to be the focus of your evening? Is it going to be a mixture of these things? Or is it going to be one or the other? Or how are you going to put all this stuff together? Because how you put this together is going to then determine how everybody else is going to observe Passover in your home. And so it's something to think about. Something to think about. As the host, it's your responsibility to make the determination about how Passover is going to be observed for you and your home. There again, the Jewish people have traditions. They know exactly what they're going to do. They know that their goal is going to be to involve their children. And you know, the bottom line, as far as the Jewish people are concerned, is that they hope that when their children go home from Passover one night, they're looking forward to Passover next year already. And this is the way it really should be. It shouldn't be an English class. It should be something that you look forward to. Now, Christians can do the same thing. In a Christian-type Passover, sometimes they call it the Christian Passover, they can focus on the redemption of the Messiah by actually explaining redemption. I would suggest that most people don't even know what redemption really is. But take and focus on what redemption really is about, and focus on the fact that with Messiah Yeshua's death, now there's access to the kingdom of God for people who didn't have it before. And focus on those types of things if you're going to direct your Passover Seder or your Passover observance toward just those things. You can use Yeshua's words, because Yeshua's words actually were intended to be encouraging. They were encouraging, they were to motivate the disciples. And so you can motivate with those words just as easily as you can take and create a somber a somber mode with those words. So you can make those a tradition, just like the Jewish people have made theirs a tradition as well. They've taken things and made them fun. Bitter herbs are not fun, but you can make them fun. So this is how this can be done. So there again, it's your focus. And your focus, even if it's a Christian Passover or a mixture or trying to stick with a Jewish-type Passover, in either case, I believe that the goal should be to take and make it to where your children look forward to it happening again next year. So let's talk a little bit about the requirements. This is our focus here. We've talked about the focus of the Passover. Let's look, though, and see what the Scripture actually says that is required for Passover. Passover requirements. What must or should a Passover observance include? And, of course, that, again, depends on your view of the Torah, as well as your understanding of what Messiah did on the night he was betrayed, and all of those types of things. So we're going to see what's required, and it could require things from both the New Testament and the Old Testament, depending on our view. But one of the things we need to understand about Passover is that our observance of Passover now is not the same as the very first Passover. We are not actually keeping Passover. What we are doing is we are remembering the Passover. There has only been one Passover. There will never again be a Passover like the first Passover. There will never again be a time when God calls on the heads of the home to take and kill a lamb, spread its blood on the lintel and the doorpost, go in there and eat dinner that night, all the time knowing your neighbor's son's going to get killed. It just ain't going to happen again. So that was a one-time event, but all of our Passovers from this point forward are to either look back, or well, they are. They're to look back at that event, but also they're to look forward to events that have yet happened. So we are to remember the Passover. In Exodus 13, verse 3, it says, Moses said to the people, remember, or zakar, this day in which you went out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, for by the strength of hand Yahweh brought you out of this place, no leavened bread shall be eaten. And so this word remember is the Hebrew word zekar, or zeker in some cases. I think zeker is actually the noun form of the word. But to zekar is to remember. So you're commanded to remember the day that you went out of bondage, came out of bondage. This is the whole purpose of Passover. Another passage here in Exodus 12, 14. So this day shall be to you a memorial, a zikron, a noun form, a zikron, and you shall keep it as a feast to the Yahweh throughout your generations. You shall keep it as a feast by an everlasting ordinance. So Passover is a remembrance of something that happened before. And at the time this was given, there was only one Passover event that has ever taken place. So we are to remember that. Another passage here in Deuteronomy 15, 15. You shall remember, this time it's Zechar, that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and Yahweh your God redeemed you. Therefore I command you this thing. So as we can see very clearly here, the Passover is designed for us to remember things. But Passover also, that was then. Now we're 2,000 years past. Actually, we're 3,500 years past that. 3,500 years down the road, there's been another Passover. And an eventful Passover. Actually, there's been a few of them. But one of monumental event, and that was the death of Messiah. And he was crucified as a Passover lamb. And so now he is a Passover that we can also look back upon too. And there's certainly nothing wrong with that. In fact, we should obviously be doing that. And besides that Passover, there's another Passover that we can even look forward to. And that's the Passover that's described here in Jeremiah 23:7. For Jeremiah says, "Behold, the days are coming, says Yahweh, that they shall no longer say, 'As Yahweh lives, who brought up the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt,' but 'As Yahweh lives, who brought up the and led the descendants of the house of Israel from the north country and from all the countries where I have driven them, and they shall dwell in their land.'" And I was talking today in the Torah study about how we've got to take this book and realize it's just a continuing story, and not pull little bits and pieces out of it and try to apply them to something that they are not designed to be applied to. All of this Jeremiah here is talking about, this is one of the many prophecies about the end time when God would restore Israel back again. And so this is the great Passover that we are to be looking forward to. And so our Zikron, you might say, our memorial should help us to remember what happened. Not only the children of Israel coming out of Egypt, it should help us to understand that there is a great price paid for our ability to now become a part of these people that Jeremiah is talking about. That God is going to draw out from the north country and from all the countries where we've been driven. So, and that was the death of Messiah Yeshua. So these are all things to remember. So Passover, bottom line, Passover is not our observance of Passover is not a reenactment of the Passover. It's a remembrance of those things. And so therefore, in our Passover observance, it's not wrong, obviously, to reenact these things. But that is not the purpose of the Passover, to reenact these things. It's to remember these things and remember why. More importantly, remember why these things took place. Now, God gives us instructions as to what our Passover memorial should include. And much of it is based on the first Passover. So let's take a look here at some of the instructions that God gave concerning Passover. Things that were included in the first Seder, the first Passover. The only true Passover. And then we'll look at some of these subsequent things. Well, there are 12 things that I've come up with that are Passover requirements, but I've grouped them here in a different way. These first seven things in here on this sheet are the things that were required of the Israelites on that very first Passover. The first thing they were required to do was to choose a lamb that was big enough to feed your family, that everybody could have a part of, but not so big that it couldn't all be consumed in one night by you and maybe, or your family and maybe your neighbor's family, because God allows you to bring your neighbor's family in as well if you'd like to share a lamb between you. You were to kill the lamb at the door of the house on the afternoon of Nisan 14. The word, for those of you who are not familiar with this, the word basin, where it says take the blood out of the basin. The basin was actually the threshold of the door. So that's how we know it was killed at the door of the house. And so you were to kill a lamb. The third thing, you were to spread the lamb's blood on the doorpost and lintel of the house using a handful of hyssop. Make a little paintbrush out of it. Then you were to prepare and roast the lamb, being careful not to break any of its bones. You were to prepare bitter herbs and unleavened bread to be eaten along with the lamb. You were to take the roasted lamb into your house and eat it along with the herbs and the unleavened bread, not carrying any of it back outside once it was brought in, but consuming all of it in one evening, every bit of it in one evening. And it specifically says all of its flesh. You're not going to eat the bones, obviously. But eat all of its flesh. And if they could not eat it all that evening, they were to burn the remainder of it. And we would suppose that would be in their home, that they would have to burn the remainder of it, because none of it was supposed to be taken outside of the house. And then on the number seven, they were to eat the lamb in haste, being ready to leave at a moment's notice, but being careful not to leave the house until summoned to do so. So these are the seven things that the children of Israel were commanded to do. That's the entire Passover event. And everything else that's listed is the Exodus. That's them actually leaving Ramses or wherever they were and getting out of town. But this is what we have right here. That's the instructions for the entire Passover event. Now, God did give three more instructions, and these three instructions actually pertain to subsequent Passovers, not the original Passover. And they are, you are to teach your children what Passover is all about. There is an instruction that no foreigner shall eat the Passover. And I want to emphasize, eat the Passover. And then the tenth is that the males must be circumcised before they eat it. So, this is all the Passover instructions we have up to that point for all Passovers, not only the first, but all subsequent Passovers when you include the last three. So, that's what we have. Now, question is then, how much of these things did the Israelites observe in that first subsequent Passover? Ever thought about that? Well, let's take a look here and see. Because there was some things that changed. God didn't change, but circumstances changed. Numbers 9, verses 2 and 3 says, "Let the children of Israel keep the Passover at its appointed time on the 14th day of this month at twilight. You shall keep it in its appointed time according to all its rites and ceremonies. You shall keep it." So this is the Passover that was observed after the tabernacle was built while the children of Israel were still camped at Mount Sinai. So this is the first Passover after they left Egypt. And Moses said, "You're to observe it according to all of its rites and ceremonies." At least that's the New King James Version. That's how you should keep it. Well, the Hebrew word here for rites is the word chukah. And it's Strong's 2708. And chukah basically means something prescribed. It's when God talks about the statutes, the laws, and the judgments, the word statutes in that passage is chukah. Okay, so it's something prescribed. This is something that God has told us how to do certain things. Okay? So this is the first word. But the second word here is ceremonies. And the word ceremonies is really a poor translation. Because it doesn't mean ceremonies at all. It means the word is mishpat. And what is mishpat? What's mishpatim? I hear someone. The mishpatim. What's the mishpatim? They're the judgments. The judgments are the mishpatim. Okay? So God is saying, do this according to all of the prescribed things and the judgments. Now, how do judgments apply here? Well, I'll show you how they apply. You have this second Passover. Okay? Now, there are certain things in the Passover that are prescribed. We went through all of them, right? But there are other things that had to be determined if and how they were going to be done. And so judgments had to be made in that regards. So let's look back at the seven things in the first Passover and to see why God said, according to all the rites or all the chukah and the mishpatim. Okay, the children of Israel still camped at Mount Sinai. So, would they have to choose a lamb? Sure they would. Okay? They still chose a lamb because that was part of the Passover, okay? How about kill the lamb at the door of the house on the afternoon of Nisan 14? Yeah, they have to do that. How about spread the blood on the doorpost and on the lintel using hyssop? No, they wouldn't have to. Why? What was the purpose of the blood on the doorpost? So it was a sign so that Yahweh would take and hover over their home and keep the angel of death from killing them. All right? This wasn't going to happen again. So judgments were made, and this would not, I would assume, I can't say this specifically, but I would just say this is a judgment call that they made. Okay, we don't have to do this on our houses. Another thing to consider is they didn't have houses. They're living in tents now. Okay, so they wouldn't have to do this. How about roast the lamb? Do not break even its bones? Yeah. Prepare bitter herbs? Sure. Eat roasted lamb along with herbs and unleavened bread? Sure. Not carry any outside? Consume it in one evening? Probably so. Eat it in haste, ready to leave at a moment's notice? No. No. So, judgments were made. Teach the children what Passover is all about? Yes. No foreigner shall eat it? Well, this was given after the first Passover, so you would assume it applies to this Passover. Males must be circumcised before they eat it? Yes. Okay, so we see how the judgments, God gives us prescribed things to do, but then there's judgments that are made in regards to how or what other things are going to be used in this regard. The word there again is mishpatim. Now, at that second Passover, there was an event that took place, and it caused a little bit of question about how to deal with these things. And so a judgment or another hukah was added. And that's because of the situation of some men who had just buried somebody and now were unable to keep the Passover. But let's look at the reason why they couldn't keep Passover. It's in Numbers 5, verse 2. Numbers 5, 2 says, command the children of Israel that they put out of the camp every leper, everyone who has a discharge, and whoever becomes defiled by a corpse. You shall put out both male and females. You shall put them outside the camp that they may not defile their camps in the midst of which I dwell. All right. So, the children of Israel could not take and eat Passover if they were in a state of corpse uncleanliness. So you had these guys, and they had apparently just buried somebody, and they were not allowed to keep Passover. Now, why would they not be allowed to keep Passover? The corpse uncleanliness, but what did that cause to happen? They were outside the camp. They had to stay outside the camp. Their tent was inside the camp. Okay? So you can't take and kill the animal at your home if you're outside the camp, you see? So what God did, he didn't make provision and say, well, I'm going to excuse you from this mitzvah. It's not really a mitzvah, this Torah commandment to not sacrifice while unclean. He just said, okay, you can do it next month. And so he created another statute, the 11th one in my list, and we call it the second month Passover, the second Passover. And so now a person who had corpse uncleanliness could still keep Passover, but he had to keep it the next month. And so he had to be careful that he didn't become corpse unclean. Or if he was out of town or something like that, he had to make sure he's back in town, because God doesn't give you more than one other chance to keep Passover. So you've got a second chance to keep Passover. If you miss it, God says you're cut off from your people, whatever that means. All right. Now, as the end of the wilderness journey drew near, Yahweh added one more statute, but this statute profoundly affects how Passover is observed today. And that statute is found in Deuteronomy chapter 16. Deuteronomy 16, verse 5, you shall not offer the Passover sacrifice within any of your towns that Yahweh your God is giving you, but at the place that Yahweh your God will choose to make his name dwell in it. There you shall offer the Passover sacrifice in the evening at sunset at the time you came out of Egypt, and you shall cook it and eat it at the place where Yahweh your God will choose, and in the morning you shall turn and go to your tents. Okay, there's a lot in this. This 12th statute basically says that the Passover sacrifice must be sacrificed and eaten where Yahweh's name resides. And so you can, Wherever God's name resides is where it's eaten. And basically, that's where the tabernacle is at any given time. So what that says is that you take your animal. Now, this is given at the end. This is given at the end of Deuteronomy. Or in Deuteronomy. The whole Deuteronomy episode probably took less than 2 weeks. So it was given there in Deuteronomy, because they were getting ready to cross over the Jordan, going to the Promised Land. And so, in fact, you can read the context of all those passages up there. And the reason it was moved to wherever God placed his name is because they didn't want to mix Passover with idolatry. Because God knows us better than we know ourselves. And he knew that the Israelite people would start getting involved in idolatry. So in order to keep his Passover from becoming a part of an idolatrous practice, he funneled it all into one place, and that is wherever the tabernacle was residing. And basically, it was at Shiloh for the first practically 400 years. So during that period of time, you had to go to that place. Now, another event happened in history that helps us to see why, basically, Passover for the Jewish people is not observed today. And that is that God didn't make a statute, create another statute, another kukha. I'm supposed to say that by choking almost. And he didn't add another statute, but what he did is he allowed Solomon to build a house for him. And it's Solomon's prayer. Jonathan was talking about that today. In Solomon's prayer in 1 Kings 8, it says, talking about Yahweh, Solomon to Yahweh, "Yahweh, have regard to the prayer of your servant and to this plea, O Yahweh my God, listening to the cry and to the prayer that your servant prays before you this day, that your eyes may be open night and day toward this house, the place where you have said, my name shall be there, that you may listen to the prayer that your servant offers toward this place." So, Solomon built this temple. He prayed this prayer. And when Yahweh took and sent fire down to that altar, and his presence began to fill that temple, God answered this prayer. And that place became the place where God placed his name. And that place has not changed since. God has not moved his name anywhere else but that place. It's still there. At that time, at that point, when that fire came down from heaven and lit that altar, the place where you can kill the Passover lamb and eat it, it was forever moved to one place, and that's Jerusalem. And specifically at the temple. And it's understood, according to the rabbis, that you can eat the Passover anywhere within the walled city of Jerusalem. To eat it outside of Jerusalem would be sin, because you're disobeying the commandment. Let's look at some of these ramifications of this. Lamb had to be slain at the temple. Now, since it was a temple service, the offerers had to be ceremonially clean. So, like we said today, just as I am, don't work. You've got to take and prepare for Passover. You cannot just decide, oh, I think I'll go keep Passover tonight. I mean, there's some thought has to go behind it. If you were going to take your animal, of course, there's some thought behind it, because if you had to make a 70-mile trip to take your lamb to Jerusalem, you'd probably put a little bit of thought into it. So you think about these things, but you had to become ceremonially clean in order to go up to the tabernacle where you could offer your offering up to the temple. From this point on, priests had to be involved in the sacrifice. Actually, priests had to be involved in the sacrifice when it was actually even in the tabernacle. The sacrifice had to be eaten within the walled city of Jerusalem. And because of the distance, not everybody could make the sacrifice. So if distance was too far for you to go, and God allows you not to observe some of the festivals because of distance, there is times when you were not simply unable to keep or to kill a lamb at Passover. Now that's not to say that you couldn't do other things. Everything else that was permitted or prescribed, you could do those things, but you could not technically keep the Passover in regards to what's shown in the Scripture if distance was too far, which, by the way, sort of our predicament today. Okay, so see, these are some of the ramifications. Now, so we have all these different things that God told us to do. And so the question now is, understanding that judgments can be made, and we'll see more judgments that were made, understanding that judgments can be made as to how a mitzvah is applied, or a Passover mitzvah is applied, or if it's required, or if it's done away with, do we have that option to decide those things for ourselves? Well, let's look at a little passage right here. We got the 12 things, but I lay it on top of that 12 things is this one verse in Deuteronomy, sort of answers it all. Everything that I command you, you shall be careful to do. You shall not add to it or take from it. So in this verse, God says you cannot add to the mitzvah, nor can you take away from the mitzvah, from the commandment. You do it as I said. So God puts his little authorization stamp up there, you might say. Now this command right here, again, was given just weeks before the children of Israel crossed the Jordan River and went into the Promised Land. The way I read this verse, Deuteronomy 12, it says you cannot add to the Passover, or can you take away from Passover? In other words, you can't make anything commanded in the Passover that's not already there, nor can you take away anything that's commanded that I've put in there. Unless, of course, it's physically impossible to do, or there's absolutely no need, like it was with the blood on the doorposts, I would say they didn't do that anymore, and I'd say that's probably physically impossible to do too. A person can make judgments if there's a need for a certain mitzvah, or if it can be performed, or how it can be performed, but he cannot add to or take away from the statute. Now, there's an example I want to share with you, and that is Hezekiah's Passover. Hezekiah, how many are familiar with Hezekiah's Passover? Okay, he took and he was the son of King Ahaz. King Ahaz was a very wicked king. When Hezekiah became king, he wanted to clean up the temple. He wanted to begin using the temple again. So he set the priests to the duties, the priests and the Levites to the duty of getting it all cleaned up. But unfortunately, they didn't get done in time. And so there was not enough time for them to do the Passover according to the mitzvah, according to the prescribed manner by the 15th of Nisan. So Hezekiah made an executive decision. And he said, we're not going to do Passover on Nisan 15. Instead, we're going to do it a month later, which, by the way, was allowed. They were not allowed to not have the Passover on the 15th, but they were allowed to have Passover on the next month. And we talked about that earlier. So he moved the Passover by 1 month. He also allowed the Levites to perform the sacrifices of the Passover because the number of Israelites that wanted to partake of Passover that year was so overwhelming, there was not enough priests to take care of it all. So he allowed some of the Levites then to step in and take over some of those things. And what's more, he invited some from the northern tribes, some of the remnant from the northern tribes who had not been driven out by the Assyrians. He contacted those people and asked them to come down and keep Passover with him. Unfortunately, not all of them came. A few from Ephraim, a few I think from Dan and from Manasseh came down and kept Passover with them. But being like it is with Israelites, they're not on time. They're always late for everything. And so they probably showed up right at the last moment, didn't have time to do a proper mikvah, and so they were unclean. And so what Hezekiah allowed to take place is that they could go ahead and offer their sacrifice in a state of uncleanliness. Now, Hezekiah did all those things, but he didn't believe he had changed the Torah in regards to those things because he repented of what he had done. He asked God's forgiveness on what he had done and what the others had done as well. The Levites who did the job that wasn't theirs, the Israelites who were not clean. He asked God's forgiveness on all of that, and God answered simply by saying, and the text only says that God healed them. So God answered them. Obviously, he approved of what happened, and it's because of their heart that God allowed for this to happen. But Hezekiah did not change the Passover. Now, the Jewish people had to make a decision about this themselves in 70 AD when the temple was destroyed. When the temple was destroyed, obviously the temple was gone, and they could no longer offer sacrifices, thus they could no longer offer the Passover, which was prescribed to take place at the temple. They no longer had a viable priesthood, so the priest now could not even perform a sacrifice, even if there was a temple. So therefore, the killing and eating of a designated Passover lamb could no longer be performed. So the destruction of the temple basically made it impossible to perform a number of Passover mitzvah. They could no longer choose a lamb. There's no need to choose a lamb. You weren't going to take and be able to sacrifice it anyway. Couldn't kill the lamb at the door of the houses. Of course, this was had long past gone. No longer spread the blood on the doorpost. They could no longer roast a lamb. They could continue with the bitter herbs and unleavened bread, and they still did. They could no longer eat roasted lamb along with herbs. They could no longer eat it. Well, they didn't eat it in haste anymore, obviously. They still continued to teach their children, which was the mitzvah. But yet no foreigner shall eat the Passover lamb became sort of a mute point, didn't it? For them, because they weren't eating Passover lamb. Males being circumcised before they could eat it, sort of a mute point. If you're not going to eat it, it's a mute point, right? Okay, we'll talk about that some more later. Second Passover, yep, they could still do the second Passover. They could have a Seder in the second Passover for anybody who is out of town or something like that if they needed to. Must be sacrificed and eaten where Yahweh's name resides. Well, that's the whole reason why they didn't do the other things, because that's no longer possible to be done. So, what did they do? They started creating substitutions. For the lamb that can no longer be sacrificed, they put a shank bone of a lamb on their Seder plate. They weren't going to eat the bone, they knew that. But that was there to represent the lamb that should have been there. So they made substitutions like that. They came up with this egg thing. I'm not too... Still ain't got that egg thing figured out. But they came up with that. So they came up with a Haggadah, or a set order, in order to take and substitute for the things that were done here. They came up with an order, an orderly process to keep Passover by, and they created things to fill in the gaps so they could still tell the story without going through the process that they were no longer permitted to do. As I was studying for this, I read an article out of Wikipedia about the Passover Seder, and it says the Haggadah, this is about the Haggadah, the Haggadah, which means a telling, it actually means to tell, is a Jewish text that sets forth the order of the Passover Seder. Reading the Haggadah at the Seder table is a fulfillment of the scriptural commandment to each Jew to tell your son of the Jewish liberation from slavery in Egypt as described in the book of Exodus in the Torah. So they came up with a Haggadah. They came up with a set order of things, a Seder of things. And I've got a few Haggadot here with me. from various groups. You might want to look at those sometime. I got one from Joseph Good. The first Haggadah we got was from Joseph Good. And as if you know Joseph Good, he's going to do it as Jewish as he can do it. So his is written from right to left. And so, but a lot of Haggadahs. We've got Haggadahs that Angie and I have compiled. All kinds of Haggadahs that are out there. But all these Haggadahs are designed to teach or to help you tell the story of Passover without having the lamb that you're going that would have normally been sacrificed. So you're welcome to come up here and look at all these Haggadot sometime. But telling the story became the central focus from that point forward. I mean, they really hammered down on telling the story because they knew that the reason why the temple was destroyed was because they had not been telling the story to their kids. And generations became more and more corrupt. And so even though they don't say that was the reason, I would submit that's one of the reasons why they said, we've got to buckle down on teaching these kids the story of Passover. And so they tried to follow the mitzvah as the mitzvah is again given in 12:24-27. And you shall observe this thing as an ordinance for you and your sons forever. And it shall be when your children say to you, what do you mean by this service? That you shall say, it is the Passover service of Yahweh, who passed over the houses of the children of Israel in Egypt when he struck the Egyptians and delivered our households. And so the Jewish people concentrate on teaching this story to their children. They really buckle down on it. So, as we see the Torah commandments that are there, as a host, it's going to be your responsibility to determine which of the various various statutes, hakot, that you want to take and incorporate in your Passover, keeping in mind that some of them can't be done. You're going to want to include all the Torah-based requirements that you can legally perform. And you may want to include elements of those that can't. I mean, you can't. I mean, there's you can't kill a lamb, but you can show how the blood was put on doorposts and stuff like that. You can incorporate these things to sort of explain the story to your children. You could take, and for example, you could take, and if you've got guests coming over for your Passover, you could take call them and say, hey, let's all together on the 10th of Nisan, go out and buy the things that we're going to need for the Passover. Let's just all on that day. Let's all do it at the same time. Maybe at 10 o'clock, we're all going to run to Brookshire's, and we're all going to buy the various things we need for Passover as our way of observing the part that we take the lamb on the 10th of Nisan. Maybe you could simulate not going out of your houses at night by saying, okay, when the meal starts, we're going to lock the doors, and no one's going to go out of the house until the Seder's over. So you can take and just sort of make these things up to sort of illustrate the things that that is part of the Passover Seder. Now, in regards to those who, and I'm one of those, who try to take and incorporate the New Testament or the death of Messiah into their Passover Seder, you've got some questions to ask yourself and consider. For one, if you believe that everything that Yeshua said the night that he was betrayed are commandments for you in regards to Passover, then you have to consider, is he adding to the Passover? And if he's adding to the Passover, is he our Messiah? So these are things you have to think about because the Torah very clearly says you cannot add a commandment to the Passover. But if Yeshua is simply making a substitution, just as the Jews have made a substitution, and Yeshua obviously knowing that within 40 years the temple was not going to be there, and so he pre-warns his disciples that there's going to be a time that you're not going to be able to eat that lamb, I'm providing you a substitution for that. Is that breaking the commandment? No. That's just providing a substitution. But then there's another thing to think about. Because if you believe that this bread and wine that's offered or given and used on Passover by many who keep a quote-unquote Christian-type Passover, if that represents the lamb that was slain for us, then you have to consider, can the Gentile eat it? Can the uncircumcised eat it? So you got to make these determinations. So a little thought has to go in this, you see. All right. Bottom line, though, in that regard is this. Let's keep in mind that without a temple in Jerusalem, there's no way we can keep the Passover. It's shown in Scripture. There is just simply no way we can do it. Therefore, we have to strive to include all the scriptural materials and be confident that you've done your best job when it's all done. Okay, my last point here is some suggestions for a successful Passover. There again, these suggestions are a compilation of things that I've come up with over the years. We keep writing these things down every year and make notes. But here's some suggestions. I got a note here. I can't understand what I'm saying here. All right. So my first suggestion is this. Come up with a plan. If you're going to have a successful anything, you have to have a plan. So come up with a plan. Passover is not the time to wing it, guys. Passover is something you should know what you're going to do before you start doing it and have it carefully laid out. Remember, you've invited people over to your home to keep Passover. They're expecting to keep Passover. And so, therefore, it's your responsibility to make sure that when they've left that house, they've felt like they kept Passover. I got a good friend, some of you may know him, but he kept Passover with some friends of his one time out in California, and they did something totally off the wall. And he tells me that when they left that night and they got back to their hotel room because they were out of town, they went down to the store and bought some bread and got some wine because they felt like they had not even begun to keep Passover that night. These people just winged it. So we need to keep in mind that you've invited people over to keep Passover. Therefore, you should be keeping Passover. You need to make sure you know what's going to happen. And then do what you have in your plan. The Jewish people, again, they have a plan. They've been doing this for so long. They have a plan. It's called a Haggadah. And so this is their plan. Anybody that goes over to a Jewish person's home for Passover, the Haggadah will be available to them. They can read it and they'll know exactly what's going to happen. But more than likely, every one of these Haggadahs are pretty much the same. But they have a way of letting people know. So you can adopt a Haggadah, you can make up your own Haggadah, you can make up your own plan, but have a plan so that you can, the people will know what you're going to do. And then again, once you have it decided, use it. And then you should share your plan with your guests. Let them know what you're going to do. Let them know what you're going to do. They may look at your Haggadah and they say, that's not Passover for me. And you certainly don't want that to happen. Nor do you want it to happen where they show up for Passover and you do something and they got this puzzled look like, what in the world are those people doing? Well, if they had read the Haggadah, they would know what they're doing. Now, granted, most people don't read the Haggadah. They just come. But at least you can say you tried. So get something, put it out on a piece of paper like this, mail it to them, post it on the internet. Give it to me if you want to, and I'll post it on the internet, and they can get it off of our website or whatever. But share your plan with their guests. And also, ask your guests, once you've shared your Haggadah with them or your plan, ask your guest if they'd like to add to it. or ask them, do you see anything in there that you think shouldn't be there? Because you may want to modify your Haggadah after getting a little bit of input. But share your Haggadah, share your plan with your friends, with your guest. Third thing is, push the button here, include your guest in your plan. Tell you what, you're going to be hoarse by the time the night's over with if you try to do the whole thing yourself. So share it with others, with your guests. Ask them to take part in your Passover Haggadah or your Passover evening's events. But be careful. Give them time limits. You don't want to give someone the responsibility of talking about the plagues because it may be an hour before they're done or more. So give them a time limit. 20 minutes. Mark tried to do that today and Ken didn't catch on. Give them time limits and say, okay, you got 2 minutes per plague. And since they're only going to talk about nine anyway, then you've got given them a 2 minute buffer because you're probably all going to talk about the 10th one in a different session. So give them time limits, but give them something to do. Help them, have them come early and help you get set up. You know, don't do it all yourself. Make them a part of your Passover experience for that evening. Okay. Try to keep it down to 2.5 hours. It's hard to do. I've for years tried to keep it down to 2.5 hours. Don't often succeed, but I still try. But I'll give you a key point on that later so you can help you to understand how to do that. You know, people like, the way to keep it down to 2.5 hours, key point is to realize that people like to talk. And you as a host are going to sometimes have to break into the middle of a conversation. You're going to have to say, okay, it's time, let's all stand up and sing a song. And there are going to be people over here talking in the corner and you're just going to have to start singing the song. And they're going to catch on. But keep it as close or under 2.5 hours if you can, because basically you're going to have a lot of kids. And when you have a lot of kids, kids don't have that good of attention span. And so if it's all about the kids, which it should be all about the kids in many ways, then try to cater to the realization that the kids are going to end up on the couch asleep before long if you don't shut this thing down pretty quick. The key to keeping the time down to 2.5 hours or less is to be organized. A well-designed plan along with constant communication with those who are assisting you will help keep everyone within their time frame. You might assign someone who, according to your Haggadah, is supposed to start rounding people up at a certain time, and you tell them, send them around and have them start gathering these people up for the next event in your Passover Seder. So keep it under 2.5 hours, if at all possible. The next one is to avoid embarrassing your guests by failing to provide guidelines for dress. And I've seen this over and over and over again, where people come to a Passover, and because they're totally unfamiliar with it, or they think it's because of their church upbringing or something, they think this is a casual event. And yours may be a casual event. But they think that it's supposed to be done a certain way. They come dressed very inappropriately for Passover. So do them a favor and give them a dress code. That way they'll know what's expected and they won't get embarrassed when they come with suit and tie and you're saying it's a casual thing. Or if they come with shorts, wearing shorts, and you're telling them this is supposed to be, we're honoring the God of Israel tonight, by the way. You know, so give them a dress code. That way you're going to at least you'll try to avoid embarrassing them. And the another point here is to avoid dead time. You know what dead time is? I used to work at a TV station, and if you've ever listened to the radio or watched TV, you'll know that on radio, there's always talking. There's always something going on. They're either playing a song, or there's some voice activity, something is always happening. Same thing in TV. If you see the color bars come up on TV, you know there's been something drastic happened at the site, or someone's getting ready to get fired. Because in television, you keep the people's attention all the time. Because if you give them 20 seconds of nothing going on, what are they going to do? Change channels. So keep the dead time to a minimum. Keep the things going. When you see that people are put all their napkins down and underneath their plate, and they're sort of looking at you, what's going on? Well, just don't keep talking to your buddy next door. You know, you've got to take and keep this thing moving. So as a host, you've got to be aware of what's going on. You've got to sense what's going on, how your people are behaving, if they're getting antsy or anything like that. Always be on top of that, but keep the things moving. So get your plan down and follow your plan and constantly be moving on this. That's not to say you can't have conversation. But I tell you what, the prime reason for dead time is the host getting involved in a conversation and losing track of time. So stay on top of it. Stay ahead of that so that you don't have the dead time. Well, when I was doing the study for this and putting my notes together, I ran across this webpage that it's a webpage from a tourism website. And it talks about participating in a Jewish Seder. And it's called Passover Do's and Don'ts for Non-Jews. This is part of it right here. And I've got the link there if you want it. I have this link on our website by tomorrow morning. This is a good site. This is a good web page, okay? Because on this web page, they tell non-Jews who have never kept Passover what to expect in a Jewish Passover. And it's good for us because they'll see, or you'll see as a host, that number one, what the Jews expect of their guest, but you'll also see things that you might want to tell your guests about so that they'll know what to expect in your Passover Seder. It's, Easter, Passover, Spring, Holiday, whatever that is. Passover Do's and Don'ts for non-Jews. What to expect when you attend a Seder. All right, so hosting Passover celebrations is a huge task, and it's an awesome responsibility, guys. But with proper study, planning, and organization, as well as input from those that you've invited over, it doesn't have to be overwhelming. And I hope this study can help you who have offered to be hosts for Passover to have an awesome Passover this year. I pray for you because this year Angie and I are not hosting. We're guests.